Welcome to Equipped, a podcast by Connection Church. Today, I am joined by Quentin Thurman, Marie Cohen, and Russ isn't there. Let's get equipped. Right. Today we are going to talk as much as we can about Exodus. I think we're all in a silly mood. Jordan is in a silly mood for sure. And this is not exactly a silly span of verses that we're to cover today. But there are a few things in here that it'll be fun to just kind of chop it up on. But just real quick, Q, I loved everything that y'all shared in the episode with the boys. That was super encouraging. Recapping Gather 25, recapping some of the Experiencing God stuff. I think that's a really good just sort of insight and preview into like what's going on in the life of our staff and the life of our church, just people being discipled, people being brought in through next steps, and you're at the centerpiece of a lot of that. So, man, I appreciate you kind of getting them going with that, and just wanted to say thank you for all your hard work, and I try to do a good job of sharing that with you privately, but I feel like there's times that you need some public recognition as well for all the hard work that you put into some, it's hard to overstate like how incredibly important the next step seat is of welcoming people that are either new to the faith or exploring the faith and giving them an on-ramp. I don't think our on-ramp has ever been wider and ever moved faster, so that's just kudos to you for that. There have been many people that have done that job well over the years, but that doesn't take away from how well you're doing it right now currently. So,
well, I appreciate that, and let me slide a 20 over to you real quick.
Thanks, man. Thanks appreciate that.
Thanks for saying that.
Next time it'll be 40.
Next time it'll be 40. Okay. But no, I've definitely been enjoying it, and definitely enjoyed making that podcast last week with Adam and Russ. It was good. Honestly, it was good to just like get a lot of those thoughts out. Obviously I share that with Tyler whenever we meet for Experiencing God, but to like have that shared experience with two other people, and super encouraging for me about thinking about going into it this next week in the next unit. And so I'm really excited.
Yeah. Have you guys, how was so theoretically in your connect groups, there should have been, I guess for Marie, maybe not for you, but the connect groups that we started the conversation in Exodus, was there anything that stood out in people first kind of looking at Exodus and the sort of first five chapters or so?
We just finished launch. We just finished the first five weeks of launch.
New connect group.
But we did talk about it a little bit at the end of last week. And so today we'll go through the first five chapters together. But I think everybody was pretty excited about it. Like nobody felt like, you know, Exodus was super foreign. Really everything we shared in that first episode of the 4:12 preview for Exodus, of like that it's a book that people are familiar with, but there's still some like mystery and some like foreign nature to it. Mm-hmm. But I am looking forward to just seeing like how people have dove into the first five chapters and what they have tonight.
Yeah. Well, good deal. I mean, in our group talking about, I think it was just a cool, like sort of a small installment around hermeneutics, mm-hmm. of the art of interpreting the Bible, in our group, of looking at 24 through 26, that we kind of the feet thing, mm-hmm. and all. We had a nice laugh kind of conversation around that. But it also like kind of gave some insight into like there are some historical things and context that until you know it, you don't know it.
And then you can never unsee it.
Yeah, and then you can never unsee it. Sometimes you see some people's feet and you can never unsee it, but just talking through some of that, of how do we, and then also kind of like being on guard of like, truly in the Hebrew, it says on the trip, at an overnight campsite, it happened that the Lord confronted him. It is an indefinite pronoun of he. It's not Moses. It's not a mm-hmm. it's not a proper a proper noun. You have to bring with you as the interpreter who is the text talking about. Some like the I think the NIV translates it as the Lord confronted Moses, and yeah. they fill in the gaps of some of that. But again, just trying to like be plain about some of the and the work of interpretation that we have to do along the way. But anyway, so it's just kind of a good installment in how do we interpret historical narratives. I asked them, like, what do you think of the genre? What do you think the genre of Exodus is? And it's funny, a lot of the guys were like, it's action.
Action.
This is an action genre. It's like, yeah, it's like Die Hard for sure.
Yeah.
Like, but Moses version. But
Moses
it's,
is John McClane.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, but I think that's fair for where we've gotten to, mm-hmm. right? But that's what makes some of this tricky. And we were kind of sitting here, I was sitting here scratching my head of like, some of like between chapters like 21 all the way until 32, it's not action. It is law code.
Mm-hmm.
It's do these things, don't do these things, do it this way, and things like that. But for our purposes today, we're going to pick up where we left off with the 10th plague in chapter 11 as Moses is now, the Lord has brought this 10th plague. And now chapter 12, it's the institution of the Passover. And so there's one thing I wanted to circle back. Let me see. I need to check something real quick. I was flipping through I was preaching from a different Bible the other day than the one I'm using now, and I had a note from when I was in, I made the note when I was in seminary maybe, but it was something that was like a clarifying thing and kind of picking up. So like going back to sort of the hermeneutics conversation a little bit, if I can find it. Well, that stinks. There was a verse and I wish I could remember what it was. Is it in that one? Is there like a note in the margin on that Bible?
Are you looking at a specific chapter?
Yeah, it's like Exodus like 6, 7, or 8, somewhere in there, or 9, somewhere in there.
I don't see anything in this one.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember where it was. But I was reading, and it stood out to me because it came up in my group, too, of where somebody was like, man, it's just a lot of like death and violence, you know? In Exodus, or really in the Bible in general, but this is where we have to continue to grow in our hermeneutics and our ability to read and interpret. There's a passage in here that explains why is God using these plagues. I wish I could remember where it is, but what the Lord says is somewhere in like chapters 4, 5, 6, or 7, or 8. Somewhere in here that says why the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. It's so that the freedom would be final. And what that means though is that this is not like a common thing that God hardens people's hearts for ultimate destruction. And I don't think this was meant for even Pharaoh's ultimate destruction. But it's the Lord makes it clear in these sets of passages, though, that this is one sort of a unique thing, but it is to establish a free people that are marked by the presence of God uniquely. Mm. And it was meant to be such that they were completely supplied. It was meant to be completely supplied for when they left, not that they would be like walking out into the wilderness partially supplied or partially free, but that this was going to be, it's one of the passages where it's like not even a dog will growl at you on your way out. You'll leave fully supplied. It's that one.
Is the verse you're looking for chapter 7, verse 3?
I don't know. Let's see.
Check it out and let me know. 3 and 4.
Mm. All right, let's just pick it up and we'll just see. The Lord answered Moses, "See, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother will be your prophet. You must say whatever I command you. Then Aaron your brother must declare it to Pharaoh so that he will let the Israelites go from this land. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. Pharaoh will not listen to you, but I will put my hand on Egypt and bring the divisions of my people, the Israelites, out of the land of Egypt by great acts of judgment." Yep, this is it. You're exactly right. "The Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh." So again, this is like supposed to be a divine attestation, or God is he is portraying who he is and what he's like mm-hmm. accurately to the Egyptians, who they're not already religiously neutral. They are religiously antagonistic to Yahweh. So God is simultaneously leveling the gods of Egypt to make it clear there is one God in heaven. Then the Egyptians will know, or the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out the Israelites from among them. And so there's another place too that God says something very similar, but it says, I think it's closer to where we're going to talk about today, that it's like, it'll be such a clear deliverance that not even a dog will growl when you leave. Mm-hmm. They'll beg you to go. And so their release into being a new nation will be complete, and it'll be completely funded. So we kind of started this conversation, Q, and you helped me a little bit with kind of remembering some of the things that we shared when we first recorded this episode. But I just want to try my best to connect the dots between what we've seen so far. Is it seems like this is a lot about, you know, we talked about in the first one, Exodus 1 is a decline in conditions for Israel. Chapters 2 through 6 establishes Moses as a deliverer. Chapters 7 through 11, the plagues are confronting Egyptian gods. We talked a little bit about that, and I talked a little bit about God hardening Pharaoh's heart in 7 through 11. So there's this back and forth exchange between Moses and Pharaoh. But then we pick up in really 12 through 21 is this, the people being led from captivity into freedom. And now what are they like in the desert and in the wilderness? What are they like in the journey going from where they are to where God promised he would get them? So in that regard, we have a lot to apply to today for us. Mm-hmm. Like, who are we and what are we like when God's brings us from where we were and who we were to where he promises that he will get us to. And so we'll try to make some New Testament application of that. A lot of what I want to focus on is this exchange later in this passage of Israel while they're at Sinai. It's really a lot of chapter 19, but we'll try to make it through 21 the best that we can today. But before I kind of start diving in and going all over the place, anything that stands out in these passages, or anything that we need to specifically talk about and cover or prepare?
I think it's exactly like you said. I think a lot of people, I heard often when I was in Connect Group that people would say, how could the Israelites be so blank? And usually it was a negative word, whether it be dumb or ignorant or, you know, whatever, silly or hard-hearted, whatever. How could the Israelites be so silly when they're seeing these amazing acts of God? And I think exactly like you said, like, it's just a good way for us to check our hearts of, actually, we're equally as silly and we have the Holy Spirit living inside of us, you know, like, no, maybe God didn't come down in front of us in smoke and fire, and he didn't part the Red Sea in front of our eyes necessarily, but he has brought us from death to life, and he has performed miracles in our lives, and we can be equally as hard-hearted or stubborn, or things like that. And so I think this is a book that is good to not, of course it wasn't written necessarily like about us, but it's easy to see ourselves in it right there with the Israelites as they're walking through the desert, grumbling and doubting and those sorts of things, because in complete transparency, we probably would do no better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we haven't done, we haven't done any better. Q, do you have anything on that?
Nothing more than what Marie's already said.
Okay. Well, I want to get to the chapter 20, some of that stuff at the interaction at the mountain. But in a nutshell, what we've got is now the plague has happened. Chapter 11, verse 9, the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh will not listen to you so that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let the Israelites go out of his land. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month is to be the beginning of months for you, so they begin the Passover. This is what becomes known as the Passover. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, they must each select an animal of the flock according to their father's households, one animal per household if the household is to. And so he starts giving instructions there. The rest of it is playing out. This is the giving of a certain law and tradition. Moses teaches the people these things. Verse 28, then the Israelites went and did this. They did just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron. So this is just literally, this is an example of just take this story at face value. It's just a story. It's just trying to tell you the events that happened. Verse 29 in chapter 12. Now at midnight, the Lord struck every firstborn male. So this is the last plague. This is the last plague taking place. And it says the firstborn in the land of Egypt was struck, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon. I think we talked a little bit about the hardening of Pharaoh's heart in the section one, or the first installment of the Exodus one. He summons Moses and Aaron. Says, take your flocks, get up, leave my people, both you and the Israelites, and go worship Yahweh as you have asked. Take even your flocks and your herds as you have asked, and leave, and also bless me. Now the Egyptians pressured the people in order to send them quickly out of the country, for they said, we're all going to die. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, with their kneading bowls wrapped up in their clothes on their shoulders. You do need to make some type of a textual connection here, that all of these events are unfolding just as Yahweh said that they would. That's mm-hmm. part of the point of Moses in that regard. The Israelites acted on Moses' word and asked the Egyptians for silver and gold and jewelry and for clothing, and the Lord gave the people such favor in the Egyptian sight that they gave them what they requested, and this way they plundered the Egyptians. The Israelites traveled from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 soldiers on foot besides their families. We're talking about 1 million-plus people. An ethnically diverse crowd also went up with them, along with a huge number of livestock, both flocks and herds. So again, their freedom now is final and it's fully funded. Verse 43, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the statute of the Passover. No foreigner may eat it, but any slave a man has purchased may eat it. Now here, that he gives him the instructions for the Passover. So you see, this not all of this is action, 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 action. Some of this is the giving of law. This is the giving of commandments. Verse 13 or chapter 13 is some of the same. The route of the Exodus and the way that they went. I'm just trying. There's one. Now the Egyptians pursue them. The famous story of the crossing of the Red Sea. That whole deal. There is something there about Israel's song. I don't remember the importance of it. I do know any time that things in scripture go from prose to poetry, right? Like, I mean, just even in looking at this, like the fact that that changes, I know something about that is important. I just can't remember what it is. I would need to break out a commentary to remember what that is. But for the sake of time, there is something about that is important, and it's usually theological in nature in that regard. But what I want to get to is fast forward to they plunder Egypt, they're set free, 10 plagues, get out of here, here's all the funding you could need, cross the Red Sea, delivered again, chapter 16, they're already complaining.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of why we teed this up a little bit with, what are you like when God is in process of delivering you from where you used to be to where he has promised to get you? Now, my question to y'all, how would y'all answer that question? Where has God promised every believer that they would get to? What are some things that it's not, how do we turn that from a subjective, individualistic thing to more of an objective Bible thing?
Is it to Sunday school to say heaven?
Yeah, nailed it. Yep. No.
At first I was like, he did say believer.
No, I guess it's another way of asking the same question from experiencing God, of what is God's will for our life?
they would make disciples.
Yeah, that we, and using Henry Blackaby language, more like that we would participate in what he's already doing in the world. But like, like in some regard, if we demystify that, that, like, you know, the old analogy, I don't know if it's old, it's one that comes to mind. Like, if you're shooting a rifle and if it's off 1 degree at 50 yards, you'll miss, but you'll probably still hit the target. But over the course of 200, 300 yards, you just want being 1 degree off over a long, long, long period of time, you'll be so far from where you were initially aiming that you won't even know, like, you won't even be able to see what you were initially aiming at. And if we move the mark of what is God's will from us bearing his image, glorifying him on earth, and making disciples, it is not going to take long in life for our change in what God expects to miss the mark so completely that it's going to wind up with us being discontent and disappointed. And so, I mean, this in this regard, like the Exodus, it shows, like, it doesn't matter how miraculous the intervention was, if they had expectations that God never gave them, they are going to wind up disappointed and discontent. And so that's where, like, you know, for our Connect group leaders, for our disciple makers, which you're already doing exactly what we're encouraging and you know, showing in this passage, but I think that hopefully that gives you language in your Connect group and in the triads that you lead or in the discipleship relationships that you have, that one of the maybe the first thing that needs to change for some of the people you're meeting with is, do they have an accurate expectation of what God has promised he would provide?
Yeah, and being willing to walk with them through that.
Yeah.
Like something I think that Alex would say is like, where is that in the Bible?
Yeah.
Where did God promise that?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not in a snarky, like, sarcastic way, but just being like, okay, like, let's work through that. Like, what does that actually, where do you feel like God has said that you deserve blank?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, like, just continuing to explore that just for a second, like, what in addition or besides that, like, what are promises? Because, like, if you can kind of look at your current circumstance and you can say, okay, yeah, I currently am grumbling. Mm-hmm. I currently am complaining. I currently am living with an ungrateful or discontent heart. What was I expecting?
Maybe one could say they were expecting it to be easy or comfortable.
Okay.
Not maybe. That that's biblical, but maybe that's still the expectation.
Could be, yeah. What else?
Hard. It's hard trying to reverse it now.
Maybe one could be expecting that they would be successful, and that's not always
prosperous.
Yeah, I don't think that's always already, the way the Lord does that, it.
But. I'm thinking back to the some of the experiencing God language that Blackaby uses of, like, I think people didn't expect to have, one, a crisis of faith moment, and then two, to have to make an adjustment in their life to participate in God's journey.
Yeah, I think most people just expect that, okay, I became a Christian, like, God's just going to use me. Like, he's going to make it super clear, and my life is just going to, like, things are just going to unfold in front of me.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, go ahead.
I was going to say, similarly to what y'all are both saying, like, I think sometimes people think of it of, like, okay, well, I got saved, and so now I'm going to take this idol worshiping lucky rabbit's foot off my keychain and I'll just put Jesus on there and I'll bring him with me wherever I go.
Yeah.
But that's genuinely how they think about it, instead of, like, now God is the ruler of my life and my king and my savior. And all of this now is only for him, out of, like, exactly what he tells me to do, to step in obedience, you know, in submission to him. But I think that it's probably the former more often, not even not necessarily because people are trying to be like that, trying to be selfish. It's just what's more normal.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just and again, to add Bible to this, like Exodus 16, the entire Israelite community departed from Elam and came to the wilderness of Sin, you know, real weirdly named wilderness there. Wonder why. Which is between Elam and Sinai. On the 15th day of the second month, they left the land of Egypt. The entire Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by pots of meat and ate all the bread we wanted. Mm. There's something in here. Like, we can romanticize our past dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
We can over-glamorize and think, like, man, wasn't this just so much better back then, you know? Or the dysfunction that I was in, it was better than the current growth phase that I'm going through.
Wasn't it just easier when I could just, like, live in my depression and just sulk and stay in my bed all day? Like, now that I'm a Christian, I have to, like, come to face with that that's not glorifying to God and that he wants more for my life.
Mm. And maybe, like, that the loneliness that I felt that fueled my depression, or the anxiety that I felt, God's now given me the gift of team and accountability and family, and now what it feels like is they're in my business.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
remember
when we sat around pots of loneliness?
Yeah. And all the bread I could eat.
And all the bread. Oh, it says bread.
It says something similar in Ecclesiastes, but again, somewhere in the New Testament, a listener needs to Google it for me. Let me know where it is. But it says something about, like, don't wish for the days when you were without the Spirit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because of, like, this tendency to romanticize it when, like, that's just not true.
That's what Solomon says specifically in Ecclesiastes, mm-hmm. is do not say the former days were better than the present days, for it is not from wisdom that you say this.
Mm.
It is foolish to say that the former days are better than the present. Which I think, like, I think Ecclesiastes is Solomon writing later in life, an older sort of now beaten down man, still full of the same spirit of wisdom that God gave him. It seemed, I think, Second Kings, maybe not First Kings, somewhere. He's a king, and he's reflecting, right? Like, some of the things he says is like, here's what happiness is. Like, enjoy the wife of your youth.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of the 1,000 or so wives that old Solomon went and married into, you know, mm-hmm. like, he's remembering the good old days of the wife of his youth. That was where happiness was, looking back.
Yeah.
But that also now as an older man, like, he's thinking about, the old days. I'm sure he probably went to McDonald's with all the other old people and had coffee with the old men at the table like people do today, and was like, you remember the good old days? You know, and he's saying it's not from wisdom that we dream in such a way.
Mm-hmm.
We can over-romanticize some of the and minimize our dysfunction and how we contributed to that, to the point that they didn't have pots of meat. They didn't eat all the bread that they wanted. They were slaves.
Yeah.
They worked ungodly hours under unreasonable conditions for somebody that gave them nothing.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was
to the point where, like, right before they take away the straw to make the bricks and say, go find your own straw.
Yeah.
Like, and then they're beating them because they can't make enough bricks because they can't find the straw to make the bricks. But they're like, ah, the good old days.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then the Lord provides. He gives them manna. I think they grumble again. He gives them manna and quail. It says to the point that, like, quail's coming out of their nose. That's one of my favorite passages in the Old Testament. It's like, we had so much quail, it's coming out of our nose. No more, no more. Chapter 17, again, chapter 17, verse 2. The people complained to Moses,
mm-hmm.
give us water to drink.
So, okay, I think this is, so as we're talking to Connect Group leaders, like, I think the common thing that most people are going to see is, wow, look at these dumb Israelites. Like, so how can we encourage them to steer the conversation in a way that is more positive, productive, mm-hmm. versus just, because I feel like even I would fall into that of, like, innately just being like, man, these Israelites, like, why do they keep, it's the same thing of like, man, Moses, why do you keep questioning God? But now it's like, the Israelites, why do you keep, like, grumbling?
Well, and that's our benefit is we get to jump all the way to the end of Exodus, right?
Yeah.
We know how the story ends. But do we, that's kind of what I was pressing on the promises thing. Do we have similar promises that we could look to? Like, you could say the whole time, like, well, clearly God, was giving them the promised land. Like, yeah. Do they not understand they're being delivered from Egypt to go be formed into like a ready-made nation? It says, as they chase the Canaanites out, they have ready-built cities, ready-built houses. All they got to do is move in. Yeah. But all of that doesn't change their groaning and complaining heart. And so what I'm asking for the believer today, do we have similar promises to point to of what is God's will for our life? Where is he leading us? And there's some other things. I'd be curious to hear y'all's sort of answer to that, though, of like, what are the things, what allows the believer today to not groan and complain as God has us in process?
One of the ones I think of, and I think this is a very overused verse, but like we can trust when he says that he's working all things together for our good. And that's something that I hold tight to if it's a situation of struggle or
for those who are called according to his purpose.
Right. For believers specifically. Yes. But like if it's like a time of emotional turmoil or like whatever else of just remembering, like it doesn't feel like it. And frankly, Lord, I disagree, but like I trust you and I understand. And I do believe when you say that you're working things together for my good and you can see the full picture and I can't, and just to keep stepping.
Yeah. And I think the key there is like, if my circumstances are producing groaning and complaining, maybe it's because I'm not living called according to his purpose.
Yeah.
I want him to be working all things for my good, for my purpose. And not remembering the school that I'm in is in the graduation process of being called according to his purpose.
Yeah.
And so there are things that he's having to pull from my fleshly hands, but that is grace. He's pulling dead things from my dying hands to usher me into a time of redemption, to live a redeemed, restored life.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are eternal purposes that I have to begin to stop operating in my flesh in order to do, and I have to stop holding on to the things, like just what Jesus says to those who he was calling his disciples, like, foxes have dens, birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Let the dead bury their dead. He's talking about living according to a divine heavenly mission that he was on. As Jesus often did, using exaggerated language to explain the divine purposes of God appearing on earth. That's when he talks about the kingdom, which we're in a sermon series on. Israel is not an instituted kingdom. They are being formed into a kingdom, but they are not a kingdom yet. But their like grumbling and complaining extends the formational process so much so that they spend 40 years in it, right? That's where we're, this is just one piece of showing that, but that would be kind of how, if I was in group, that's a theme, a theological theme to be drawing out is, you know, you think of lots of different seasons. The newborn season, which I know will be very prevalent in my connect group. The wanting to be at a different place in your career but not being there yet. The wanting to be more spiritually mature but not being there yet.
Okay, Jordan, you can stop talking about me.
you're out in yourself. Yeah, newborn. But I mean, I think those are things that, I mean, you are just a good like lightning rod representative of lots of people in our church. You know that many people have already walked through that season, and are. That's why praise be to God that He gives us an eternal word that we can come back to and address these things generation upon generation. But I can know, in whatever current season that I'm in and whatever past season that I've been through, grumbling and complaining and rejecting, pushing God away while he's in process, I'm missing the very thing that he's wanting to do in my waiting, what he's shaping and forming me into, that doesn't change like the very real difficult scenarios, the miscarriage, the diagnosis, the serious crisis of events. That's not to, I'm not talking about these crisis broken, severe, stricken type moments as like God is causing those things in order to teach us something. I'll give you a solid hour 30 on that conversation. But I'm talking about when you're between where you were and where God has clearly promised to help get us to. I can look over here on where is God planning to get us to, which is clear. He wants us to be able to glorify Him with all the days of our life and make disciples of all nations. And so for us, called according to His purpose, where I'm at between where I was and getting there to be a full-blown participant in His kingdom, I can be mindful and learn from the Exodus that grumbling and complaining and running from God along the way is just going to delay me getting to where God wants me to be.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting to think about that way of like, and again, a lot of this, some of this is speculation of like, I don't know exactly what God would have done if they wouldn't have grumbled. Like He didn't preserve that part of, He didn't preserve that, you know, like, well, but it is easy to look at this and be like, oh, if I complain to God like the Israelites did, He'll give me manna and quail. But to think about it in the way of like, He wanted to give them something so much better, but because of their quarreling and their grumbling and their attitudes, it was drawn out. Like the manna and the quail wasn't a blessing or a gift. It was just, here's something to sustain you, I guess. Which again, I'm kind of speculating and speaking for God in a way, but like to think about that way of like, it wasn't a gift from their grumbling. Their grumbling prolonged their suffering. Am I off?
I think the spirit behind what you're saying, I don't disagree with at all. Just for clarity of language, like I think even in our dysfunction, God gives us more grace than we deserve.
Yeah.
The manna and the quail are literal bread from heaven.
Yeah.
Like that is a gift of grace that they didn't deserve.
Yeah.
And I mean, it could have been like, hey, here's 40,000 scorpions. Pick these up and boil these down. And
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
just ready baked, already made bread, like angelic bread from heaven. That's a gift, you know?
Yeah.
I picture the little elvish bread from the Lord of the Rings. That's,
yeah.
That's what I picture. But I think there's something really theologically important in there that we don't turn God's fathering of us into works righteousness, that He gives me good gifts when I do good. He gives me bad gifts when I do bad. That's what an earthly father is like.
Yeah.
A heavenly father meets them in their dysfunction and gives them grace that they didn't deserve. But there's something that, so here's the other answer to part of the question that I was thinking through of like, what has God promised? And the other thing is He's given the Spirit living inside of us. That's another big lesson from the Exodus, is that this is what people are like when they're called according to God's purposes that don't have the Spirit of God living in them. We are the new Exodus. We are the post-resurrection Exodus. The church is in an Exodus into the world to make disciples of all nations. And we are meant to be what it's like when we do have the Spirit of God living in us. And that kind of gets us into the chapter 20 conversation, or chapter 19 conversation. Anything else on that?
Good,
Marie?
Good.
Okay. So water from the rock. I mean, some of these things are very similar sort of conversations. Like what they're doing is grumbling. They're complaining. They see that with the manna and the quail, the water from the rock. Even Moses doesn't do the water from the rock thing right. We'll see that, I think, later. Jethro comes to visit, Uncle Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, comes and just gives, you know, tells him to structure all this differently. Moses is at the center of too much of this. But now let's talk about Israel at Sinai. And I would say just sort of in summary, I guess all I'm trying to get to with this is I don't know. I guess we kind of need to, do we just need to slow down and just have an extended conversation on this? Or do you think just summarizing it would be fine?
Summarize it would be fine.
Okay. So I can't find the exact spot. What me and Marie and Q have talked about before is when I was in seminary, my Hebrew professor helped us in the class unpack and see there's something in the Hebrew text that does not show through in English. In short, what God was inviting the people to do was to come up the mountain and be a kingdom of priests to experience his presence and experience his voice in a personal way. What they did in the moment when they were supposed to act in obedience to come up the mountain is they hesitated and made Moses become an intermediary, and so they became a kingdom with a priest instead of a kingdom of priests. See the difference?
Mm-hmm.
And so if y'all could help me find some of the vernacular of that, some this kind of in here. You can very clearly see it when
it's 1912 tells them not to.
So put boundaries for the people all around the mountain and say, be careful that you don't go up on the mountain or touch its base. Oops, sorry if I bumped the mic there. If anyone who touches the mountain will be, put to death. No hand may touch him instead. That's what I remember from class. Again, you had to go and do some of your own study on this, is that that's running up the mountain in an unworthy manner. It's running up the mountain with a lack of reverence for who God is. Marie, you helped me see this last time when we recorded this, and I just can't.
Yeah, it's right after that, I'm pretty sure, where Q pointed out, and it says right there, kind of towards the end of 13, when the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they may go up to the mountain.
Okay, so that's where, yeah, exactly. Thank you. I guess I could just keep reading. But that's where the English muddies it. So are they supposed to go up the mountain, or are they not? Like, what? It sounds in English, when you look at it in English, it sounds confusing. It sounds like, do they, don't they? When the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they may go up the mountain. You fast forward sort of to the end of this exchange, and they don't.
Mm-hmm.
The ram's horn sounds, and they look at Moses. Where am I at here?
So while you look for that, I'll read right here in this commentary. It kind of expresses exactly what you're saying about that ram's horn blast part. And it says, the people could only come near at God's invitation, and the trumpet signaled that invitation was open.
It's 2021.
20 verse 21. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Exactly. Moses responded to the people, don't be afraid, for God has come to test you so that you will fear him and will not sin. And the people remained standing in the distance as Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. It's even backed up from there. All the people witnessed the thunder and lightning, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain surrounded by smoke. When the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. You speak to us and we will listen. They said to Moses, but don't let God speak to us or we will die. This is the main thing that I'm trying to draw out. This is one of the big lessons from Exodus, is this is the fruit of a people trying to relate to God through God's relationship with another person. And I hope you could feel that as a connect group leader, for all of our connect group leaders. This is why we use the 412, the life transformation questions. Because I would watch for years and years and years of people try to live in relationship with God through the relationship that the connect group leader had with God.
Mm-hmm.
They were just drafting off of the spiritual vitality of the connect group leader and their zeal and their energy and their passion and their study and their prayer life. And they would get filled up on Sunday, and they would get filled up at Connect Group, and filled up at Sunday, and filled up at Connect Group. When in all actuality, this is the same thing. You go and talk to God for us. It's the same spirit. When what Moses is trying to highlight for us as today as the reader is you can't have a relationship with God that way. You will not produce the fruit. In other words, back to what Marie drew out with that New Testament passage of God will work all things for our good for those who are called according to his purpose. So for every believer, we are called to participate in his purpose, to have, and again, Blackaby language, like we were created to have a love relationship with God personally. And when we delegate that intimacy to another person, we will not live a life either with the attitude or with the purpose that God intended us to live with. So this is not primarily about, in my opinion, the giving of the Ten Commandments as the best thing we could do to put in elementary schools. Mm-hmm. I know that our podcast listeners can't see this, but I'm just showing y'all. Here's the complicated set of interactions in 19. There's the Ten Commandments. There's the conclusion of the action. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Ten Commandments is just like a parenthetical of here's the giving of the law. Mm-hmm. It's that the human heart can't live out these laws without a personal relationship with the Lord. And they were invited to come up the mountain to have a personal relationship with Yahweh, and they rejected it. The fear of the change and the fear of the dynamic and the fear of the intimacy, and maybe that's probably even reading too much into the text. I'm sure they were like on the other side of this black cloud. I'm sure they weren't thinking, oh, it's too much intimacy. I'm sure it was a little bit more of like, what is this going to cost me? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, that's something that I see. I see there. Any thoughts on any of that?
I mean, yeah, I see, and maybe you've like said it, but just to say it again of like, they were afraid. Like they saw God's character, not that he is to be feared, but they didn't see like the love of God and like being in relationship with him. Like they saw the fear of like, we need to stay away from this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And even like thinking about the experiencing God language and kind of we're like meshing Exodus and experiencing God together, but thinking about like that is like, how do you know when the trumpet sounds if you're in relationship with, like, it's kind of crisis of faith, and mm-hmm. then you make it, but like, how do you know like to have a crisis of faith like if you're not in relationship with God? And I think especially for people today, like if you're not experiencing God, if you're not living with God, you know, through whatever spiritual practice or walking with him, like you aren't going to hear the trumpet sound and then, you know, like join him in the work that he's already doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I think this is going to sound so weird. Moses could always sit around a campfire and say, I ever told you a story about the time God almost killed me for not being circumcised? You know, like he would always have that personal story, whether he chose to say it in a funny way or not. I have a feeling Moses didn't have the greatest sense of humor.
He couldn't speak well, you know, so couldn't tell a joke.
Jeez almighty.
No.
Oh man, that's funny. But like he could always use that as a lesson of like, I was moving in generally in the direction of what God told me he wanted me to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm living my life in that direction. So any correction that comes into my life as I'm moving in that direction, I just know is the fatherly hand of God that I can trust because I'm moving in that direction. Accountability always has to be agreed upon, right? We talk about that a lot with just overall like staff life. And if we're not moving in the same direction, the accountability that I hold you to is not going to matter. It's going to feel like condemnation instead of correction.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of them experiencing the correcting hand of God along the way, I mean, some of it is like these people just suck. Like it's a million people. Like what Moses intended, what he writes down, both from Exodus, Numbers, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, is that the Exodus event was always meant to be this moment that created a national identity. They always look back and say, remember when you were set free from Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
There's this, I mean, even the New Testament harkens back to it of like, this Exodus moment was supposed to be this moment of national remembrance of we can never deny, like the circumstances, the events, like, who was I talking to? Maybe it was in our Connect group, like in kind of fleshing out Exodus, like there's a tomb of a former Pharaoh dude that the inscriptions are in Hebrew. There are 12 little pyramids around the one big pyramid, and it's a shepherd's hook. It's an unusual inscription, and it's almost for sure Joseph.
Mm.
And so, like, it was there. Am I in the middle of just? Am I fainting? Am I still? am I in a fever dream?
You're there.
There was supposed to be such like clear archaeological, historical, verifiable facts around these events in God creating a new people for himself, that the past was undeniable, that God had been at work, that the sea parted, that today, like, you can go and find remnants of chariots in the bottom of the Red Sea from some cataclysmic event that happened, right? Like, there's evidence upon evidence that God, that, and this is the theological story of this was what God was doing in his activity in the world. And Israel is choosing to reject understanding this is what God's doing in the world. They're like, they're interpreting God's hand of correction as cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess all I'm saying is you and I can do the same. But
yeah, I have a commentary over here, and it just like, just exactly what you guys are saying. It says when, you know, where it talks about let not God speak with us. It says one might think that Israel loved the dramatic experience at Mount Sinai, and especially the honor of hearing God's voice like a loudspeaker from heaven. Instead, because of the great awe and dread they felt, they wanted God to stop speaking to them directly. And then later, of course, where it says, let God not speak with us lest we die. It says man's desire for a mediator, someone to act as a go-between with us and God, is only good if it is fulfilled in Jesus Christ. For there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Jesus, the man Christ Jesus, which is from 1 Timothy. And I thought that was just awesome how they were able to kind of pull Jesus into the picture too, you know, because like, I think it's easy to sit there and, I mean, of course, I think the Israelites did struggle, but to sit there and point the finger at the Israelites, but forget that, like, we also probably would want a mediator, and we have one in a good way, not in a bad way, not like a Pope mediator that we have to go, a human person that we have to go to hear God's voice, but Jesus, fully God and fully man, that is working on our behalf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a beautiful way to kind of wrap this up, is that, like, they had a past event to look back on and say, look at the good news of God's deliverance. We have the same. We look back at the cross today and say, look at the good news of God's deliverance, of how he has brought us out of our own Egypt, right? He set us free from slavery and captivity. And this is sort of the big, like, gospel-lensed point on the Exodus, is if we didn't have the Spirit of God living in us, we would be the exact same. Mm. We would grumble in an unnecessary way. We still do sometimes, right? But it's the Spirit of God that makes us discontent and rebukes us of our sin for grumbling about God's process of how and the way that he is developing and cultivating something in us. And so that's where, I mean, in reading the book of Exodus, read it with the gospel in mind of in all ways, right? Like creation, fall, redemption, restoration. Like, where are we at in this sort of major four-part storyline of understanding the Bible according to the gospel? Where are we at in the Exodus of understanding the book of Exodus according to the gospel? So on the next time we record, we're going to skip all the way to chapter 32, because everything between 21 and 32 is law code, law code, for the most part. Like, maybe there's something kind of interspersed between there, but it is a lot of detailed information of the giving of the law. And I will try to talk a little bit about why that is. But what you could see is that there's an abundance of clarity, of communication, of like real, personal, practical communication from God to his people. Chapter 32, they throw all the gold that they plundered Egypt in into a hot barrel, and out comes a golden calf. And so we'll pick up talking about 32 through 40, and we'll try to talk through that next time. But we hope this has been encouraging. We hope this has been good. Q, Marie, thank you for taking time to be a part of this conversation today. Sorry if I sound like a lunatic, and we'll see you next time on Equipped.